Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and this is It's Hot in Here, and we are here to give you your daily, rather weekly, dose of environmental, tangentially environmentally related news, grooves, and views this week. I am one of your co-hosts, Jennifer Johnson, and here with me is...
your other co-host, David Clive.
It's great to see you, David.
It's great to see you, too.
Awesome. I am great. And I'm very excited today because Mark Clegg, professor at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, is here with us. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Jennifer. It's great to be here.
Awesome. Well, we are excited, and perhaps this is very fortuitous, because just at 10 o'clock this morning, the Confederate flag, which has caused so much debate, which was flying over South Carolina State House grounds, was removed. The flag was on the Confederate Memorial that had previously, we're clapping here, had previously flown from the State House dome. And I watched this live, and I'm sure y'all can see this yourselves on the internet. But in the moments before the flag was being removed, the crowd was chanting, "Take it down, take it down." And after it did indeed come down, there was a broke out into a chorus of na 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 na, hey hey hey, goodbye. So there's some happiness there. The flag is not going to disappear, but will be moved into the Confederate Relic Room and Military Museum in South Carolina.
It's amazing, and it's amazing how powerful, really, this kind of social acknowledgement of our symbols is.
Yes.
Because usually, I think one of the things I found in my research about the Star-Spangled Banner mm-hmm. is that something we sort of take for granted. We don't really think about the words. We don't think about what it means. We just sort of get caught up in these rituals, and no one really
the
notices.
The compelling melody and the
when this debate skills. Started, I was on, you know, traveling with my family, and we were just, like, seeing these kids in Virginia just, you know, walking around with Confederate battle flags on their shirts. You know, they were, and uh-huh. it was just sort of a decoration. It was sort of neutral. It didn't mean anything
yes.
per se, but of course it means everything.
Yes.
So the way in which our identity and our ideas are shaped by this environment is very much a social construct and something we can make choices about like we did today.
Absolutely. And great choices were indeed made after that 12-hour debate in the South Carolina.
Is that how long it was? 12 hours?
12 hours. Mm. Over 12 hours, they say. And we can thank the governor, Nikki Haley, for signing that legislation
yeah,
to remove
the flag.
The shift
absolutely.
It's so quick and really amazing. I didn't think it was going to happen.
It's phenomenal. And so just 2 hours ago, this happened and causing us really to rethink these kinds of symbols. There was a conversation that, oh, it's our history. Mm-hmm. But what is that history?
Is it a history you want to celebrate in the way that we've been celebrating it? Or at least that they've been celebrating it in South Carolina?
As a question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never been to South Carolina, so I can't say what happens there with any sort of fairness.
Yeah, but. Well, I've been to Charleston really for many, many years. It's an incredible place. And, you know, of course, the tragedy that started this conversation is, mm-hmm. is really something we shouldn't forget to think about as well. I mean, mm-hmm. just the killing of 9 innocent people at a Bible study group, for of all things. So, but the... You know, those kinds of tragedies had happened so many times in our history mm-hmm. and not prompted mm-hmm. this kind of reevaluation, or really sort of thinking through what kind of messages we're sending with, you know, sort of patriotic discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on one hand, it's something we want to just smile and cheer and, you know, be at a football game and, you know, see the flag rise up and the stars and feel all unified.
Our swelling hearts and our sense of patriotic belonging.
I mean, there's something beautiful about that for me.
Sure.
But it also is saying things. And I think that's as a music historian, one of the things that I'm most interested in is this kind of social aesthetic of music, is that it's never just entertaining. It's never just a way of making a living. It's always a way in which we're sort of becoming who we are, mm-hmm. right? This kind of tool for living that shapes the world around us. It doesn't just reflect it, right? There's this kind of symbiotic back and forth between the things we say about ourselves and the things we do to have fun and the
yes.
things we do to party
yes.
and all that and actually who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really, for me, it makes you know, when I got into school, it was all about how music transcends. And like, we think Beethoven is still great because 200 years later, we're still playing Beethoven. So it's so awesome. Uh-huh. But it's not connected to who Beethoven was as a person or what was going on in Vienna, all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. But actually, it's always about both those things. It's always about the music and the pleasure it brings us, but it's always about the social context.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, that's an excellent segue into our first tune today, which is a Sharon Jones version of This Land Is Your Land.
This land is your land. Yeah.
All right. That was Sharon Jones with This Land Is Your Land. And Dr. Rebecca Harden has joined us in the studio as well from the wilds of downtown Ann Arbor.
Something about Sharon Jones just conjured me.
It's true. It just magically appeared.
I hear her voice and I start popping out of bottles and stuff.
I love it. I love it. A musical genie.
Yeah.
No. So we are here with Mark Clegg, who is a professor. You would say, so you've referred to yourself as a music historian.
Mm-hmm.
Also a musicologist.
Yeah.
And
so different.
Are they?
A musicologist is the one we use in, you know, the tenure portfolio in the music historian.
Yes.
When we're talking to civilians, we use that word.
I like it.
When you speak to the lay people.
Who a music historian is
I'm a music lover. That's the thing.
It's beautiful.
You do it, and I get paid to do it. That's what's really incredible.
Yes, how fantastic.
That's totally amazing.
That
the word you can use here at WCBN-FM Ann Arbor is the music lover term. Mm-hmm. That works fine.
That works fine.
In these studios, yeah.
Absolutely. And so you have been working on music for quite some time. Let's be serious. Your first book came out with the University of California Press in 2008, The Memoirs of Alton Augustus Adams, Sr., the first black bandmaster of the United States Navy.
Mm-hmm. So issues about race and music, I think, have always fascinated me, in part because of this notion of sort of the politics of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you're, you know, Sharon Jones and you sing This Land Is Your Land, on one hand, you're just singing a song by Woody Guthrie. On the other hand, you are making
really
a political statement, right? So if you are
song,
a black
right.
woman from, you know, Atlanta, Georgia, born in 1956 before the Civil Rights Act was passed, right? And you say, this is my land and it's your land. You're doing way more than just sort of singing a children's song. And so it's those kinds of sort of performative political acts, I think, that about music that fascinate me. And then this song, in fact, you know, the thing that's amazing, I think, about these patriotic symbols like the battle flag, you know, when we can say, oh, it's just about our heritage, or, you know, it's just innocent. These things are never innocent. I mean, they're always born of a particular historical circumstance. They carry meanings that, for all of us, you know, are unique to our own experience, but also that have this kind of collective effect on the unconscious in some way. So This Land of Your Land, for instance, is actually originally titled God Blessed America for Me, and it's a protest song written by Woody Guthrie, who was really annoyed about the fact that in 1940, the only thing you could hear on the radio was Kate Smith singing Irving Berlin's song, right? And that song has a very complicated history, because it actually starts off as a kind of isolationist anti-World War II anthem, like God Bless America, I'm glad that we're so blessed, and those European people are, you know, killing each other over there across
and we're
the
talking
sea.
About God Bless America.
Exactly, that song.
Land that I love.
Right.
Stand, but we all know it, right?
Yep.
So that is canonical.
And it's so strange, even just starting to say those words, the feelings that come up of this
of
like happiness and pride are so bizarre.
Through the night with the light from above.
Yes.
You guys are good. I think we should go on the road.
From the oceans.
To the highway. No, wait till we start dancing, though. That comes later in the hour. And it does
sometimes
get
later in
here.
The evening, yes.
Yeah, but there's in any event.
There's an intro to that song that we don't sing anymore, right? It's When the Storm Clouds Gather. So it's talking about sort of the rising conflict of Nazism in Germany.
Pathetic fallacy.
And then the great thing is, isn't it cool that God blessed us and we don't have to get involved, right? And then
really?
Irving Berlin, who of course was a prominent Jewish composer, sort of went, wait a minute. When, you know, the truth started coming out, and the whole meaning of that song started to shift. And the, you know, again, the way we interpret things has so much to do with what's going on in the world around us.
Well, you used the words earlier this conversation, social construction and the social construction of symbols. You were talking about that flag coming down in South Carolina, but I guess the point about Sharon Jones singing This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land is that it's a totally different constructed meaning. I mean, it's a context that shifts as well.
Right.
So I guess that can happen with flags, and it can happen with songs, and it can happen with all kinds of symbols and meanings. And then we're in a situation where if your construction is harming me, we got to figure that out, which is what we're kind of doing, it seems to me, in this country right now on a huge scale. And it's so interesting. But yeah, Sharon, I had not heard that version. I had not heard that song before.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Thank you for sharing it.
It's one of my favorites.
It does remind me that there are some land issues going on right here that we've addressed on this show recently. And let me just, before we talk more about music and symbol and patriotism and flags and subversive deployments of different symbols, I know we're going to get into all that, but let me just give our listeners a quick update on an issue that we had quite a few call-ins about a couple weeks ago, and that is the land along the edges of Geddes Road on the way into town here in Treetown, Ann Arbor. Many of you are aware that the Geddes Road area has had some safety concerns about cyclists, people with disabilities, really anyone rolling for any reason, skaters. And Gallup Park is a big zone for rollers of various kinds, kids learning to ride bicycles, three-legged dogs, you name it, right?
There's all kinds of people on wheels, dogs on wheels.
There's all kinds of rolling going on. So we're going to talk about rolling for a minute, and we'll get back to the rock in just a moment. But I wanted to let our listeners know that we appreciate all of you who did call in and voice concerns and opinions about the fact that to make things safer in that area of town and more accessible, there's a widening of Geddes Road that's been proposed and that was evaluated by the state as having zero environmental impact, whereas there are many, many old trees growing in the region that was going to be flattened. They were going to be chopped down and removed in order to create another lane and a what they're calling a grassy knoll on the side of the road. So lots of you did weigh in, actually, a grassy knoll. Isn't there something about that word that, after Sharon Jones, just sounds like it ought to be unpacked, grassy knoll?
Yes.
So I just wanted to let you know that I have another letter in my hand that is a letter that is addressed to concerned citizens.
Which we all are.
Which we all are, and especially here at Hutton here. And it is from Sonia T. Butler, the chief of the revolving loan section in the Office of Drinking Water and Municipal Assistance at the Department of Environmental Quality. This is coming out of Lansing, and so it's on Rick Snyder letterhead and Dan Wyant, the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ.
Looks very official.
It's super official. You can hear it.
It's real paper, people.
Hear the officialness?
Actual paper.
Yeah, it's super official. Actually, it got handed off to me on a dog walk this morning by a neighbor who was like, oh, we got another letter. There's a kind of a bit of a grassroots thing happening, grassroots, a tree root thing. I just actually got a sign from the engineer that was a pre-printed sign that says, don't rustle paper, please, which I think may be intended for people reading notes.
I think that was a joke, Cameron.
It was awesome.
He's saying double thumbs up. That was indeed a joke.
Okay. Thanks, Cameron. We'll knock that off.
I'm glad the humor translates through the glass window.
That there's a pre-made sign that says, do not rustle paper is such a helpful thing. And yes. I just want people to think about what goes into good radio. So the markers, the magic markers that go into good radio. So we've received, says the letter, a number of comments in response to the May 14th finding of no significant impact. And I want people to know that because of the phone calls and comments and the radio broadcast we did, DNR came back out and met with citizens. And the long and short of it, I won't take too much time, is that we've kind of compromised. I've heard from neighbors and friends and scientists who were concerned about some Indiana bat populations in the area that roost in those trees and that were concerned about a range of other ecological impact issues involving stormwater and drainage into the Huron Basin if we put a bigger highway there. Mm-hmm. I've heard that what's happening now is that the DNR, the DEQ, have decided again that there's no significant environmental impact, but city engineers have been out this week talking with people, looking at trees, and staking the oldest, biggest trees, including a 200-year-old black walnut tree. Mm-hmm. So there's been some compromise, and we've definitely managed to save quite a few of the oldest trees that were in the path of this grassy knoll progress. So I think that's a really positive thing. I wanted to just let folks know that there's still a need for engagement and monitoring of the way this whole thing unfolds. We've done a great job of making a little difference in the way the project is being planned, getting a little more transparency and close consideration from state and city levels. And the city engineers we'd like to thank for spending time coming out and really hearing residents talk about where are they seeing bats and where do they see trees that shouldn't be disturbed before moving ahead with their plans on the project. So that's all good. There are still concerns about stormwater. There are still concerns about The Economist this week ran a story on how the U.S. is the most dangerous country to drive in the world. Highest number of fatalities. And it's partly because we have big roads in dense areas where you can drive fast. So whether safer is faster, bigger, wider, grassier is another concern. Stay engaged. Let folks know. You can write Sonia Butler at the DEQ. You can write us here at Hutton here, and we can help you orient any of your questions. But thank you all for your engagement. This land is our land. It is, in fact.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Just have to say a small RIP to those trees who will not get to grow to be 200 years.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
They never even had a chance. Or they had some chance.
I mean, this is a we live in a democracy. Here it all is, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, the rolling has to happen and the driving has to happen and mm-hmm. the trees, at least some of them, need to be allowed to grow and get some mm-hmm. respect. Mm-hmm. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. I am a really, really old tree. I'm going to get out there and start singing. But thank you. Thank you all of our listeners who've engaged in that issue and stay engaged.
Thanks. Awesome. And thank you, Rebecca, for that fantastic update.
Yep.
Again, we're here with Mark Clegg from the University of Michigan School of Music, Dance, and Theater, perhaps not in that order. And you have spent a great deal of your time recently thinking and doing various compositions with the Star-Spangled Banner. What was your initial sort of interest in this project?
Well, what sparked it for teaching you? Here. I would teach a survey course on American music,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to get students, you know, thinking and talking about issues of, you know, again, what are the ways in which this seemingly passive act of just having the radio on in the car as you drive past those 200-year-old trees, and, you know, what does that mean? And a lot of times, you know, people will sing songs, but they actually don't even, they may know the words, but they never even ask themselves, well, what do these words mean? Or how does, you know, what kind of imagery is being put out there? It seems like something that's just decorative, something that's just pop culture, you know, sort of meaningless on some level. And I wanted people to start thinking about, you know, what meanings might be there and what ways might we be actually sort of imbibing all of these kinds of concepts and ideas in a kind of unconscious way and make that more conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And so the entry point I've been using is Jimi Hendrix playing the Star-Spangled Banner at Woodstock on August 18th, 1969, because it's an incredible musical, you know, tour de force.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's the thing that really sells it, is it's amazing art making, but it's also art making with a message.
Yes.
And I think that's what really got me going on it. And it's also an ambiguous message. Like, you're not really sure what's going on. It's sort of, it's got all the sort of fame and iconicity of Woodstock. It's got this superhero psychedelic guitarist, you know, so there's something immediately appealing that grabs people, like something's cool is going on.
Uh-huh.
But then when you start to say, well, why is Taps, you know, the sort of Civil War tune for the dead, what is that doing in the middle of the Star-Spangled Banner? Like, what's up with that? And what's up with all this sort of, like, you know, firefight, you know, psychedelic, improvisatory noise and feedback and sort of gunfire all happening sonically. And what does that mean something? Is that just sort of like the Hendrix thing or whatever? So it's then asking, you know, really deep questions about, well, where exactly is this happening and what could it mean? And then again, you know, what's going on in 1969 mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. the United States, in New York, in the country, you know, that might... This is it possible that this music is either asking a question or answering a question?
Well, I think we should keep that in mind when we set the scene by listening to Jimi Hendrix's Woodstock version.
Do we get to?
Yes.
Well, we get to.
We've got it queued up.
You sure do.
Let's
Thank
go.
You, Cameron.
Ha 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 ha
So, Mark, what was happening August 18th, 1969?
I want Rebecca to sing Purple Haze next. That's what
you know, you laugh, but if you give me an inch, man, I will take a mile. So I would just back right off that statement. Right? No, I actually shut my mouth. That song shut my mouth. I that was amazing to listen to. I have nothing to say.
It's an incredible statement.
It's in my head.
I guess my main point, you know, having heard this thousands of times probably at this point, I mean, I just love it more and more every time. But I think he's not playing the Star Spangled Banner. He's actually singing the Star Spangled Banner with an electric guitar.
Yes.
Right?
Mm.
So, you know, just like with Sarah Jones, so if an African-American woman is singing "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land," if you are, again, an African-American male with a guitar in 1969 and you're singing "This Is My Song," the Star Spangled Banner, I mean, there's an immediate identity claim, right? That I have the right to play this, that I have the right to play this in this way. You're at a countercultural event for American youth.
But you're also saying I'm rock and roll and I'm black at that moment, no?
Exactly. I mean, really, Hendrix, he's in between a lot of different identities, right? Because this is an original sort of black psychedelic rock is not so much a category either, right? You're supposed to be R&B, you're supposed to be jazz, you're supposed to be, you know, doing other things. So again, psychedelic rock doesn't really make sense in Harlem for Jimmy any more than it makes sense for, you know, Monterey pop.
So it's a genre.
There's a way in which these kind of juxtapositions of symbols of identities that happen in art, right, make us mentally have to think about, well, why are these things together? Is this collision or does this juxtaposition mean something? And that's, I think, what happens with Hendrix's Woodstock anthem. So, you know, the fact that Taft is in the middle of there, right, which is, again, this military bugle call that honors sort of a eulogy for the dead, the ones who sacrificed. And you know that Hendrix himself was a member of the 101st Airborne, which had been deployed to Vietnam, that he, you know, grew up as a black man in America. And the reason he got in the military was that he was picked up on sort of a trumped up, you know, car theft charge. And he was given a choice, like, you can either go in the military or we'll put you in prison. And so he went into the military. And this happened to a lot of African-American men. And, of course, more African-American men died in the Vietnam War than any other subgroup in the United States, and which was why MLK was a real anti-war advocate. We need to think about him as, you know, just a sort of safe civil rights guy, but he was a radical figure, and part of it was his anti-war advocacy.
I was just standing a week ago at the Milton Olive Park in Chicago, which is right behind Navy Pier, and I was telling my 12-year-old daughter and her friend to please read the plaque on that, because it's a memorial to an African-American private who was killed in Vietnam by throwing himself on a grenade and saving six or eight other people by so doing. And it's just a reminder that, I mean, it's in the middle of that city, which it may be one of the cities in which the race conflict is the most kind of gargantuan in some way. It may not be deeper or worse or more intense, but it's just enormous in Chicago in some way, I think. And I was really struck by that, by the kind of silence of that memorial to those particular kinds of victims in that war. And I hadn't thought about the connection between that and this version of the Star Spangled Banner so much, but it's there, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The other connection, of course, is with race riding in the United States in the late 60s and MLK's death, his assassination, and all those things were really poignant for Hendrix. And I think we tend to think of Hendrix as a kind of drugged out, you know,
he was putting acid on his bands around his head and all
that stuff couldn't mean anything. But in fact, I think that what we really find is that Hendrix was a very involved political thinker. So he's singing the words of the Star Spangled Banner, right, while he's playing it. And when it gets to, "And the rockets red glare," that's where he goes crazy, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
"The bombs bursting in air," that's where he goes nuts. So those psychedelic departures are really word or sort of sound pictures that are painting and telling a story about what's happening in America domestically, the sort of war for civil rights, and what's happening in Vietnam, in another sort of war, you know, with deep human rights consequences. So these symbols, again, are all part of a kind of discussion of a social discourse that people really heard because of it being done at Woodstock.
So did that song get instant traction? Like, did it just instantly, what we would today call go viral. Mm-hmm. But except, of course, then I don't know what happened. I mean, was there a kind of, how was it received in the moment?
That's a great question. So the surprising answer is no, right? What we'd think the answer would be absolutely, like people mm-hmm. would go nuts. But people didn't go nuts for one very important reason, which is that the festival famously, you know, had all sorts of technical problems. They had huge crowds show up that they weren't expecting. They, you know, it became a free festival because they trampled down all the you know, fencing and
yes.
they couldn't control the crowd and
yes.
blah, blah, blah. But there's also a huge rainstorm and all sorts of, you know, health issues. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. But so the result is, Hendrix, who's the biggest star of the festival, right, is closing the festival. He's going to be up last on Sunday night.
And it's been
doesn't actually go on until Monday morning. Right? So this famously is played basically at sunrise on Monday morning. But the press has already filed all of their reports. All the reviews have been sent in Sunday night. So the New York Times review of Woodstock doesn't mention Hendrix's Star Spangled Banner. All it says is, yeah, maybe tomorrow, hopefully Hendrix will get to play. Right.
Oh,
so it's pretty much absent from the immediate
wow.
discourse.
Which is amazing because
right.
when anyone thinks of Woodstock, that's the first thing they think of, I think.
And it does come in later, and there's a Rolling Stone review, and then he's on a national talk show. But there's not like some huge explosive thing.
Well, so it also makes us, those of us working in media now in any capacity, realize what it means to have our phones and our capacity to capture mm-hmm. things in the mm-hmm. moment, which just didn't exist.
What it means right. to be able to see a live cast of the Confederate flag coming down over the State House
exactly.
of South Carolina.
Because,
yep.
right, or of a woman climbing up it.
Uh-huh.
To take it down
right.
a few weeks ago, which mm-hmm. we should also mention on the air, I think, today as a uh-huh. kind of really interesting, I mean, I don't know what she thinks of Jimi Hendrix, but it's an interesting chapter as well in the kind of performative arena.
Mm-hmm.
What about the crowd? Do we know much about the crowd? I mean, presumably he was sort of playing to anyone who had been left standing.
Yeah, the crowd was
the
much smaller, so it was
right.
probably around 50,000, which is a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But if you see the Woodstock film, so we did get lucky. I mean, there's no phones, but there is a documentary film that was being made of this by Michael Wadley, and that it was really that film, I think, that makes the Hendrix anthem so powerful and so much an icon of sort of rock's potential for protest and sort of the 1960s. But in fact, you know, I guess some other reasons. In retrospect, it's not that surprising that Hendrix's anthem wasn't that so much a big deal at the time. One thing is that really public opinion had long turned against the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, Hendrix was a little late to the party,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
Muhammad Ali is, you know, refusing to go into the draft in like 1964 and bringing up a lot of these issues. This is like 5 years later. The mm-hmm. Tet Offensive has already happened. Really, public mm-hmm. opinion has completely soured. So Hendrix is really more of a kind of, he's coalescing. He's bringing together all these streams of ideas more so than sort of being on the leading edge. The other thing is that Woodstock, it turns out, is only one of about 60 or 70 performances of Hendrix playing the anthem. We think of it as a kind of, you know, ecstatic improvisation where he was just moved by this amazing moment at this festival to play it. But in fact, it's a polished composition that he'd been working on for over a year prior to that.
Wow.
And it's a whole sort of flexible group of symbols that he improvises in the moment, I think, to sort of paint a picture of what's going on in the United States. And where this is really clear is from a series of performances at the Winterland Ballroom in October of 1968, where it's actually the sort of an anniversary concert for the experience, and they've got a real professional recording gig. And I think Hendrix is sort of trying to make an artistic summary of what his art and what the band's art is about. And he plays this tune that he titles from the stage, "This Is America." And in all of these bootleg tapes and these kind of live audience tapes, this is where you really see the sort of Hendrix's thinking at mm-hmm. work. In his public statements, I think on mass media, he was pretty obtuse and if anything, sort of, I think, you know, trying to confuse everybody.
Deflect it.
Mm-hmm. He didn't want, mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want controversy if you're trying to sell albums on a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was talking to his fans in a live show, he was much more direct about what he was actually up. So I think we have cued the introduction
yes.
from the October 10th performance, which is pretty amazing. But you'll hear
October 10th, 1968.
Yeah, mm-hmm. at the Winterland Ballroom. And this is Hendrix about to play the Star Spangled Banner and telling us what it's all about.
Before Woodstock, right?
Before Woodstock.
Big time.
America, representing the sounds and the feedback which you'll hear is really lost souls and frustration, it seems like to me. I don't know, the weirdest messengers, you know? And like, you know, if we can get this feeling across to you, maybe through all this racket that some people think we're making up there. always like a rock of hell. It's a thing, you know. You get tired of playing notes sometimes, so you really want to play or get close to playing exactly what you call a true feeling, regardless if it's or, you know, or if it's one of those doo-doo-doo-doo. And you know, those guys like, wait, hold on, hold on. Right. Yeah, there's something from the sun, brother. And it begins off, that's the you know, you hear the hang-up side, which will probably be lasting about 5 or 3 or 2 minutes. And then you hear our side of it, which we'd like to say thank you very much, Osley.
not the kind of introduction I was expecting.
No, it's sort of this Ornette Coleman-inspired free jazz intro where there's just kind of atmospheric, you know, improvisation. But it's this dystopian picture of what's going on in America, right? And I think it's the title he gives this whole experience, right, which I really think of as a kind of tone poem, right? Again, telling us a story, is, and he titles it, "This is America." So for him, what he's about to play and the song that's at the center of it, the national anthem, is really part of this much bigger image of what's going on. And it's pretty troubled, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, the four shows at Winterland and the way in which he unpacks the anthem there. It gets, he's inserting commercial jingles like the Mickey Mouse Club theme and the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports. He's putting taps in, and then sort of the whole piece just sort of explodes and into silence. So if we wanted to see Woodstock as a kind of, you know, insult to the flag or a you know, deconstruction of the flag, we would hear something more like Winterland. Right. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing about, I think, reading Winterland against Woodstock is that you start to see that Woodstock's actually pretty positive in a certain way. I mean, it's complex. It's got issues. Mm-hmm. Right. We've got this things to solve. But we're here at this moment with 300,000 young people who are sort of taking the country back, or at least showing their political force, because, you know, it freaked Nixon out that Woodstock happened, right? I mean, he gets really worried about musicians and music from then on. Mr. Lennon and the Beatles know all about this. So it's showing the sort of the social force that could be galvanized through this kind of discourse that's happening among young people. You know, and of course, there's the Democratic Convention in Chicago, there's all sorts of issues where youth, and really Ann Arbor and the University of Michigan is right in the middle of that, right, with Students for a Democratic Society. So there's a huge moment of sort of youth empowerment, and Hendrix is looking out and thinking, yeah, this is great. This is something we can really do. And so he plays the anthem, and he plays every single note, and he plays every single note in tune, and he ends with the anthem, and he puts these sort of troubling images in the middle of it, but it does end with the land of the free and the home of the brave, right? You know, as a way that it doesn't end that way in Winterland. In Winterland, it ends with taps. It ends with death. It ends in mourning, right? So it's a complex set of ideas, and he's using it really in a much more sort of, I kind of say, fine-tuned, if you will, political way to comment on what's going on right there, right at that moment.
I would love to hear another version of this as we had planned initially, but in the interest of time, I think we should also open up the possibility, and certainly your work has demonstrated this, that these are not new kinds of debates or conversations necessarily around this piece of music.
Yeah, I think in many ways what Hendrix is doing is not such a radical thing. As we saw today with the Confederate battle flag coming down, these kind of symbols are being debated. And what the mistake is, seeing our symbols as something that's sort of absolute and unchanging.
We might also parenthetically just throw in the new challenge to the Redskins as a symbol, which came this week as well. I mean, there's so many examples in the U.S. any given week, really, but this week seemed especially full of contested symbols. Publicly contested symbols,
and the flag is getting us to think about, you know, how many elementary schools are named after all of these war heroes, right? That some of which were founders of the KKK, right? So it's there's a lot of the way we talk about history is never innocent, right? History is really more about the future than it is about the past, right? So when we choose to remember something, we're also sort of communicating aspirations of where we want to go or what we want to continue to do, what we want to repeat. And so I think that if we see all these things as choices, right, not as absolutes, right? So the number of flags and stripes on the Star Spangled Banner, I mean, there's certainly a tradition, but we could change that. Like, if we wanted to do something different, we could.
We could just cut a couple stripes off the bottom
You could do lots of things, but
there's
I guess the
Robin Williams stand-up video that was circulating around 4th of July where he pulls off his sleeve and reveals the new number of stars. It's a funny physical performance. I mean, it's Robin Williams, also RIP, right? But there are people who do play. There's a kind of ludic, like there's a little play with that sometimes, even in our kind of what we think of as collective pop culture comic consciousness, I guess.
So one of the things, my research, I think maybe the most surprising thing for me is how much the Star Spangled Banner has actually changed, right? So in my lifetime, it feels like it's this thing. It's this kind of monument. It's like a mountain or some kind of, you know, masterpiece sculpture. It just doesn't change. But in fact, in the 19th century, we sang hundreds of different lyrics to the melody we now know as the Star Spangled Banner. And what Francis Scott Key was doing was just adding another set of lyrics to that political discourse.
So how did they stick?
How did they stick? Well, there's basically a historical accident that makes Key's lyrics survive when all these other ones disappear. Mm-hmm. Part of it is the U.S. Civil War, right? So the fact mm-hmm. that the Union holds that the mm-hmm. flag of the Star Spangled Banner and the song are in this kind of symbiotic relationship, and the flag survives, right? So the song and flag are sort of both, I think, more deeply entrenched into American identity after the Civil War than they were before. Mm-hmm. And you see that because of the decline in the 19th, or into the 20th century, we now see the national anthem as sort of this sacred thing, mm. right? For Key, it was just a victory song. It was a party tune after we had beat the British, right? It was not, he didn't write a national anthem. Nobody writes a national anthem. National anthems happen, you know, because of the way people use them. You, mm-hmm. you don't compose them mm-hmm. in advance. But it becomes sacred in the 20th century, and we stop messing with it. In the 19th century, it was a kind of political rostrum for sharing ideas. And one of those, which I think is the most powerful version I've discovered, is this abolitionist text from 1843 that was published here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in an abolitionist newspaper called The Signal of Liberty, and then was picked up by William Lord Garrison and republished in the Liberator and sort of made into this national thing. But it's called Oh Say Can You Hear. Mm. And this tune, what's happening at this point, sort of after Francis, because Francis Scott Key's song, which is initially titled The Defense of Fort McHenry, becomes pretty popular very quickly and becomes associated with American identity. And so future commentators sort of play on that relationship by echoing the words to say, mm-hmm. in the case of this tune, mm-hmm. Land of the free? Really? With all of these African-American people enslaved? I don't think so. And yeah, so
that's not actually funny.
Yeah. It's the text that they're manipulating.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
So let's hear the first verse of that.
Love it.
What year was that written in again?
1843.
That was extremely graphic.
It's extremely graphic. And I think, you know, it's actually reminds, if you look at a lot of photographs coming a little bit later, but it's the illustration of sort of the results of whipping and the scarring mm-hmm. that it causes on the backs of these human beings treated as things. That's in some ways so moving for abolitionists and for public opinion. And, you know, this text really hits that right on. It is very descriptive, very graphic.
Instead of banner streaming, it's blood streaming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the contrast between the piano trills and then the lyrics about lashes and blood. I mean, it almost creates cognitive dissonance for me to listen to it.
No? Absolutely.
It's wild.
Yeah, well, and it evokes the plantation scene for me.
Yeah.
And those contrasts like within the plantation scene. Right, right. Right. 12 Years a Slave. Right, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
It's an amazing text, and I think really the most devastating one I found. But it's really part of this very common cultural practice of people writing lyrics to well-known tunes and sharing ideas, celebrating events. You know, so there were texts written to the melody we know as the anthem that celebrated George Washington's birthday, that celebrated the 4th of July, which we started celebrating in 1777, that were campaign songs for Thomas Jefferson or John Adams or William Henry Harrison. There are temperance songs because, you know, one of the big women rights health issues in the 19th century was alcoholism because of the sort of gender bias of the age. The family's sort of, you know, if in a sense the connection to the outside world was through the husband, through the father, right, who had to be employed. And the domestic sphere and the public sphere, you needed the man to go out. And if the man was going out and getting drunk all the time, it was a big public health issue. So the temperance movement was located in the church, and this was a very powerful thing. And a lot of church hymnals have a section in the back called sort of national songs, and they'll have the Star Spangled Banner. A lot of them also have these arrangements or other texts, like singing of the, you know, the beauty of cold water and as an alternative to alcohol and sort of these anthems. And in fact, the very first four-part, you know, sort of choral rendition, which is how we often sing the anthem today in these sort of, you know, beautiful four-part harmonic readings, the first ones were done for churches for these temperance texts, not for the keys text at all.
So then that fed back into the keys text and the ways that it gets performed.
Yeah, so this is just a pattern of public discourse. When we get to the 20th century and we start treating Francis Scott Key's words as semi-sacred, right, after we make it the official anthem in 1931, after sort of World War I and World War II, and again, this sort of just increasing scale of bloodshed that this war represents, we stop changing the words, but the commentary and sort of social protest comes through the musical arrangements, right? And I think that's where we see the sort of same tradition. So for me, what Jimi Hendrix did and what Francis Scott Key did, what, you know, Aggie did with the Oh Say Do You Hear abolitionist text, it's all part of the same story of figuring out who we are as Americans and what it means to be a citizen, right? So in Hendrix's case, it's this kind of psychedelic citizenship. But we think of the Star Spangled Banner now as something like true, immutable. For Francis Scott Key in 1814, it was a dream. Like, he saw this very weak country, that the British were walking all over us, right? He wanted to vision this really glorious future. And he puts that in the anthem. Today we see that as kind of like, you know, manifest destiny. This is who we are. We're awesome, right? But it's something,
that's
again.
That's what they teach you in school.
Yeah, that's what they teach you in school. They leave out the fact that Francis Scott Key owns slaves, too. I wonder why that is.
It's the inconvenient truth.
Yeah. So it's, you know, American history is complicated. It's mutable. But it's ultimately a choice. And I think what I find inspiring about studying the anthem and sharing it with people is that it gives an example of what it means to be a citizen, to do things. You know, whether that's, you know, going down to Getty's Road and just or having people look at the tree line and say, wait a minute,
coming down to
this.
The studios here at WCBN-FM Ann Arbor and engaging and talking and having
exactly.
conversations. I think and that question of what citizenship means. I wonder if you, speaking of that's what they teach you in school, I wonder if you encounter uncomfortable pushback moments in your teaching on this sometimes, or in your work, maybe on campus outside the classroom, in terms of some of the politics of cultural performance. I think about this past year, we've had tricky situations with films that are and are not worth screening on campus, for example. I don't know if you followed some of these debates about whether, I mean, do you ever get into difficult conversations that you find to be part of the reason this is worth opening up?
Absolutely. I mean, it does in some ways strike right at the heart of who we are and who we hope to be and what we think
we are. Who we disagree about being.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And we have this time of incredible polarization in our country that to ask some of these questions and sort of acknowledge the contingent nature of American greatness, if you will, right? There's something we have choices about. It's something that changes rather than there being sort of kind of an absolute, you know, traditional way of doing things. And that word tradition is often what's set up, like traditional marriage, right? The traditional version of the Star Spangled Banner. What's amazing to me is what Francis Scott Key sang and what we sing today are actually mutually recognizable, but very different, right? So there's mm-hmm. one of the very last line of the text, the Oseidas, that Star Spangled Banner, Yet Wave, is sung twice in Francis Scott Key's Day. First, the whole thing is sung by a soloist, and then the audience actually echoes back that last line,
nice.
Right? The rhythm's different. The melody's a tiny bit different. Mm-hmm. It's you would still recognize the same song, but we can't go back and say, oh, we're going to sing it in the original way, because the way we sing it today is not the original way. It's a way that's come up. And I think I find mainly that it's military veterans, you know, who've been mm-hmm. with military bands. And ironically, every single military band has their own version. The Army does it differently than the Navy, does it differently than the Marines, because they all
really?
Want their own special arrangement. So even within the military, there are differences in how the anthem is performed. But the kind of, I think what people want is a sense of respect, you know, played, particularly if you've been in the military, if you've been overseas, if you've made really deep personal sacrifices for the nation. And we have to also remember that most of those people making those sacrifices are from, you know, the American underclass, right? They're the ones who are African-American, Native American, who don't have a lot of money, who see the military as a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. So we really, there is, I think, a sincere debt, and I feel that very strongly as well, that we, you know, really need to convey respect for that sacrifice as well as the opportunity to do things and differently in the future.
So it sounds to me like it's a really constructive and important thing to carry into teaching and into kind of public circles on these questions, this idea that we just want to constantly be taking apart the assumptions we have about tradition and constantly be, you know, open to the idea that they aren't fixed. It's got to be hard at times. And I know that it's also the case, you referred yourself to the way that Hendrix's art making kind of anchors the way you can, you know, there's an interplay there, right? Something becomes tradition, it becomes art with a capital mm-hmm. A, and then it enables all these opportunities at the same time that you want to kind of pull that apart. It's
right.
tension, I guess, in your own work in some ways, but it's interesting to listen to.
It is.
And those interested in really getting deep into some a recent piece that Mark has published are encouraged to check out our website, where we will link to the actual
As always.
Article. Our site is hotinhere.us on the internet. But there's an excellent article link that we will post to that Mark has written entitled This Is America, Jimi Hendrix's Star-Spangled Banner Journey as Psychedelic Citizenship, which is just so cool. I mean...
Well, thanks so much for having me on. There's also a website, starspanglemusic.org.
Yes.
Which is largely aiming at like K-12 teachers.
Uh-huh.
So I just, because I think these kinds of discussions, if we can have them with young people, is a great
time to
start.
Well, that's the time to do it. In fifth grade in Medina, Ohio, in order mm-hmm. to pass music class, we all had to stand up and individually sing the Star Spangled Banner, mm-hmm. basically in the same exact way.
And we've all
it was
been
terrifying, and I love singing.
We've all been talking about these symbols and how fixed we think they are. And when I was a kid, that's what I was taught. You know, the flag means this. This flag means this.
Our founding fathers meant this.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, the Star Spangled Banner means this. But when you pull it apart, you know, like you said, Mark, they're not fixed, and they mean different things to different people in different times. And it's just, I think if I had maybe discussed that with teachers and my peers at a younger age, then, you know, that would have been, I would have had a better educational experience, I think. Mm-hmm.
It makes rebellion feel different too, I guess. And the possibilities for rebelling against certain kinds of definitions become very different when you build that in. Mm-hmm. I wonder. It's fascinating. But I do think, I guess I also wonder what our next anthem-like exercises are going to be in this country. I've been thinking so much about Amazing Grace and the recovery of Amazing Grace in recent weeks after the mm-hmm. eulogy in Charleston as a song that's not just about faith in a kind of circumscribed and religious context, but rather about faith in a national capacity for healing and for having exactly the kinds of conversations. I mean, it's almost as though what happened in Charleston is this effort to suture together Christian hope and grace with the kind of challenges of retaining national unity and civility with one another as we face these kinds of tasks. I don't know what do you think about that, Mark, as a kind of parting conversation before we...
Well, I think the thing that your description just brought back to me so clearly is the power of music, right? So the 19th century, the Broadside Ballad and Key and Hendrix and President Obama and Charleston, you know, they're putting ideas out there, but they're putting ideas in the way that sort of undeniably reaches our heart. And it can just sort of communicates a human truth that sort of, I think, makes us more receptive to ideas. And this kind of discourse in words where we're constantly battling each other and there's a sense of, I don't know, prestige or ego, somehow music allows us to get to a more human quality where we start to realize that the pain and suffering and joy and happiness and hope are something that we share. Mm-hmm. And that there's a kind of way in which music is a universal language. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking about how it's not. Right? But yeah. It reaches our hearts in a way that I think is really powerful. And that's what's so special.
Yeah, part of it was just to see a president stop speaking and start to sing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that act in itself was enormous. And yeah, I don't know if we have a version of Amazing Grace to go
sing
out
some
on,
more.
But if
I think
we
need to sing more,
yes. Well, we'll be singing and perhaps crying as we listen to this version of Amazing Grace delivered by Barack Obama several weeks ago. I would like to thank everyone for joining us, most especially our listeners. Thank you for tuning in to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Aside from those listening, we couldn't have done this today without Mark Clegg and your expertise. Thank you so much for joining us. You can, what is the website address again? I'm a terrible
Starspanglemusic.org.
Starspanglemusic.org. It is a beautiful site, and you can find out more about that. There is an album on iTunes as well of all of these fantastic versions.
And we're heading into Bastille Day, so if you want to go storm a prison or anything else exactly. That sounds patriotic to you, here we are in this interstitial. We're all celebrating independence and the power of change. So on that note,
thank you also to Cameron for engineering, and we'll see you next week.
This week, an open heart. That more than any particular policy or analysis
That's right.
is what's called upon right now, I think.
Yeah.
What a friend of mine, the writer Marilyn Robinson, calls that reservoir of goodness. Beyond and of another kind, that we are able to do each other in the ordinary cause of things. Mm-hmm. That reservoir of goodness. Mm-hmm. If we can find that grace, uh-huh. Anything is possible.
Yeah. I'm not.
If we can tap that grace, uh-huh. Everything can change. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. How sweet. Sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was and found that grace. Ethel Lance found that grace. The Payne Middleton doctor found that grace. Tywanza Sanders found that grace. Daniel L. Simmons Sr. found that grace. Sharonda Coleman Singleton found that grace. Myra Thompson found that grace. Through the example of their lives, they've now passed it on to us. May we find ourselves worthy of that precious and extraordinary gift. As long as our lives endure,
mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
May grace now lead them home.
Well, yeah.
May God continue to shed his grace on the United States of America. Yeah.